Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, and behaviorism about curiosity, and makes these useful for everyone. My name is Simon Brown. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage, and today I'm here with my co-authors, Paul Ashcroft.
Hello.
And Garrick Jones.
Hello.
And we're delighted to be joined by John Hagel, consultant, entrepreneur, speaker, and author with 40 years in Silicon Valley. John has recently retired as a partner from Deloitte, where he was the founder and co-chairman of the Center for the Edge, a research center with branches around the world. In the 80s, he was senior vice president of strategy at Atari, and has worked at McKinsey and BCG, and is founder of two Silicon Valley startups. He's driven by a desire to help individuals and institutions around the world to increase their impact in a rapidly changing world. He's founder of Beyond Our Edge, and that helps companies and individuals to anticipate and address opportunities for exponential growth. He's now published 8 books, and his new book, The Journey Beyond Fear, was released on the 25th of May this year, and we'll hear more about that later in a moment. He's won 2 awards from Harvard's Business Review for best articles in that publication, and he's been recognised as an industry thought leader by a variety of publications and institutions, including the World Economic Forum and Business Week. It's an honour to welcome you to the Curious Advantage podcast, John.
Hello there.
So let's kick things off with your recently published book, The Journey Beyond Fear. Dan Pink says of it, with sharp insights and compelling cases, he shows how to move past fear to improve performance and deepen meaning. In a business world that often resists talking about emotions, this book is a badly needed guide to enlisting psychology in the service of your strategy. Powerful stuff. So maybe let's kick us off, if you could give us a quick overview, John, as much as you can do in a couple of moments, for our listeners.
Sure. I actually started writing the book about 3 years ago, and I travel around the world as part of my business, and I was struck by the fact that everywhere I went, the dominant emotion that I was encountering was fear. And while I think that's understandable, I think it's also very limiting. And so the focus of the book is, how do we move beyond fear by cultivating a different set of emotions that will encourage us to take action in spite of fear? So that's really the overarching view of the book.
So in that, you cover 3 pillars. So narratives, passion, and platforms. So maybe we can dive a little deeper into those. And maybe if we can start with narratives. Could you tell us a bit about narratives, John, and why narratives aren't, or how they're different from stories, which is what I initially thought of as narratives?
Now, well, as we'll see, I have a tendency to want to define terms in a very unique way. So that starts with narratives. Everybody views narratives as the same as stories. They're synonymous. For me, the distinction is stories are self-contained. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end to them. And then the story is about the storyteller, or it's about some other people, real or imaginary, but it's not about you. You can sit there, use your imagination, think of what you would have done in that context, but it's not about you. In contrast, for me, a narrative, the way I define it, is open-ended. There is no resolution yet. There's some kind of major threat or opportunity out in the future, not clear whether it's going to be addressed or not. And the resolution of the narrative hinges on you. It's a call to action, to say your choices, your actions are going to help determine how this narrative resolves itself. And while everyone talks about the emotional power of stories, I come back and say the narratives that in our history have led people to actually make the ultimate sacrifice. They've given up their lives for narratives. And so I think that we are missing the real power of narratives by conflating it into stories. And I believe that narratives, especially what I call opportunity-based narratives, are a key to helping us move beyond fear. If we can identify some inspiring opportunity out in the future that's not going to be achieved until and unless we act and others act with us, we're going to be, you know, still living in fear. So I think that it's a powerful way to move beyond fear.
So John, if a narrative and a powerful narrative gives meaning and gets us started on the journey, your second pillar really interested us, passion, particularly the passion of the explorer. There's a lot of connections here with what we write about curiosity, as curiosity being having an attitude of wonder and a spirit of exploration. Could you tell us some more about the passion of the explorer?
Sure. Now, again, everyone talks about passion. I find that the meanings are very loose. Everybody has a different meaning. If I survey a room, I'll find as many different definitions of passion as there are in the room. For me, the passion of the explorer is a very specific form of passion, and it comes out of research that I did looking at environments where there's sustained extreme performance improvement. Where do we see sustained extreme performance improvement? And a very diverse set of environments, but what I found was that every participant in those environments had this specific form of passion, the passion of the explorer. And the way I define it is it starts with a commitment to having more and more impact in a specific domain. You are really committed to addressing a domain and having impact in it, not just being in it, but making more and more of a difference there. Second attribute of a passion of the explorer is somebody who really has what I call a questing disposition. They are seeking out challenges all the time because they realize that's the way to have more and more impact in the domain they've chosen. If they're just sitting there without being challenged, they're not going to have as much impact. They get excited by those challenges. And then finally, there's a third element of the passion of the explorer, which is people who have this passion, their natural reaction when confronted with a challenge is to immediately think about who else can I connect with who can help me get to a better answer faster. So they're constantly seeking help from others to address the challenges that are going to help them to have more and more impact in the domain that they've chosen. So it's all about action and impact and excitement about the action and impact that they potentially could have.
And John, particularly we would recognize that final aspect where you talk about community. And we talk about this in our book, One of the Seven C's of Curiosity is finding your community and taking your community with you on your curious journey. So I think we'd really recognize that.
Yeah,
it's great. See an overall linkage as well with the choose your domain and seek challenges in that domain and how you can further that domain, which we often asked around you, is curiously aimlessly wandering, which I know you need to choose what it is you're curious about, have that, you know, direct line of what it is, and then explore within that domain. So I see a lot of linkages between this passion of the explorer and the curiosity we talk about.
Now, in reading the book, I was struck by the connection between these two concepts. And again, I think it's ultimately choice of language and words, but I think we're talking about very much the same thing.
I would agree, yeah. And then tell us about the third pillar as well then. So platforms, but not just any platforms. So you talk about learning platforms and how we can help people to learn faster. So tell us more, please, John.
No. Well, this is, again, platforms is such a widely used term, and everybody's today talking about platforms. We're all on platforms. But my view is that most of the platforms that we have today are either what I would call aggregation platforms, where the focus is on facilitating short-term transactions, buying and selling, for example, a retail platform. Or, I need access to a specific piece of data. I go to a platform to find that data. Done. Job done. The other kind of platform that's popular today is social platforms, platforms that help us to connect with friends and family and stay connected. And that's fine. But it's all about social connection, social relationships. The missing element is what I call learning platforms, where the primary design of the platform is to help the participants to learn faster and to do it together. And again, here I make a big distinction because most people, when I talk about learning platforms, say, oh, well, we have all kinds of platforms where you can access video courses, video training courses. Those are learning platforms. Well, yeah, maybe. The learning that I'm talking about, again, I tend to focus on definitions, is learning in the form of creating new knowledge, not sitting there listening to somebody lecture. It's acting together in a way to really come up with new insight as to what will have more impact. And it's platforms that will help people who are committed to that form of learning that really are not available today. I mean, there are early elements of it. You can think of platforms like some of the open source software platforms, but it's still very early stage in terms of really having this as the primary focus of the platform, how to help people learn faster together.
Yeah. I love that idea of the platforms. I find it your definition extremely helpful. It made me think about one of the platforms of the past, which you could argue were the city-states in some respects, especially the highly configured city-states of things like the City of London, maybe 300 years ago, and certainly the Republic of Venice, 900 years ago. And so the thing about the platform as a kind of knowledge platform, when you shift it back to the city state, because we in our curious research, we were looking at neuroscience and behaviorism and anthropology and history and so on. And we came to Venice because of the way they organize themselves, and we talk a lot about the scuole and the way that they organize knowledge within the Republic of Venice to enable the entire thing to be a machine, if you like, for exploration, a machine for generating wealth at the time. And you wrote about Venice as well, which was, of course, rang our bell on a fantastic LinkedIn piece, which where you wrote about the guilds in Venice, which we touch on too. And we both think that guilds and the way that they're structured and their knowledge-propelling structures have valuable lessons for us for today in the digital age. What are your thoughts? Can you tell us a little bit more about your thoughts about guilds and knowledge and how we can apply them today?
No, I think that it's an important thing to study in the sense that I believe we're actually heading back to the future, if you will. We're going back to guilds. Everybody today is talking about the gig economy, that we all are just going to become independent contractors and we'll freely associate and connect to do tasks and projects, but then we'll be moving on. I believe that in a world that's more rapidly changing, we have to find ways to learn faster, and we're going to do that together rather than doing it as isolated individuals. I'm strongly of the belief that no matter how smart you are as an individual, you're going to learn so much faster if you come together with others. And in that context, I'm very impressed by the role of guilds in the earlier part of our history that really focused on helping to people to learn certain crafts and skills so that they could do more in terms of work. And so I think that the interesting thing to me, I'll just do a bit of a detour on this in the sense of coming together to learn, at least my belief, and I developed this quite a bit in the book, is that the most powerful learning unit is what I call an impact group. It's a small Yes. group of people, 3 to 15 people, who have deep trust-based relationships with each other and who are challenging and supporting each other to learn faster. And then connecting those impact groups into broader networks so that they can scale their learning by learning through the experience of other impact groups. So I think in that context, again, the guilds that I see in the future are going to be organized around these small units, but be focused. Again, the primary goal of these new guilds is going to be to help the participants learn faster together around particular domains that are meaningful to them.
That's really helpful, that idea of the impact group. I mean, I think of complex dynamic systems, and as soon as the volume of interactions take place in a complex dynamic system, even if you do scenario work, you start to see strange attractors emerging and things that are similar being clustered together in some time. So you could argue that that's an inevitability. We are moving towards a future in which people who have similar interests or knowledge move closer together. But the idea of formalizing that into impact groups, I think, and then clustering them is fascinating and very useful. I mean, in Venice, for example, you had a group who were focused around navigation, another one focused around strategy, another group focused on accounting and business, another group focused on map making, another one again on shipbuilding, and all of these, and then Titian, the painter, was his guild of painters, which he got from the ships and invented this whole idea of painting on canvas, which we take for granted now. But the idea of these little groups and impact clusters or impact groups and guilds formally moving knowledge forward, I mean, I really think it is, as you say, back to the future is coming with a vengeance. There's an important message in the book you have about moving beyond our own narrow human potential and our individual challenges and looking at broader societal change. Can you share a little more of your thinking there, John?
Yes, I think that, one way I have of describing the past several decades is that we have two broad movements. One is broadly under the human potential or human growth movement, where it's all around helping individuals achieve more of their potential, address their challenges and obstacles, and have more impact. That's the human potential, human growth movement. There's another set of movements that have been moving in parallel for the past several decades, which broadly are classified around social change movements. They're trying to change the institutions that we have, the economy, the communities, the society that we have to be more supportive of people. Interesting observation is those two movements have been moving in parallel for decades, and they've barely interacted with each other. My view is that until and unless they connect, because you can do as much as you can with every individual to get them to develop the motivation and passion to learn more and have more impact. But if they're in an institution that is deeply suspect of passion, which, by the way, I believe all our institutions today are deeply suspect of passion. As long as they're in those institutions and communities that are suspect of passion, they're not going to achieve their full potential. So we need to find ways of changing the environment that we're in, the institutions, the communities, so that it encourages us to really pursue these passions and have more impact. And the two together will be very powerful.
Yeah. The bringing together of the individual and also the social change movements or the human potential, as you say, I think is... But do you have a sense of a scenario, perhaps, that might emerge? Are there any weak signals that you're starting to see that may emerge where they bring coming together?
Certainly there are some companies and institutions that are starting to see the need and opportunity to get more impact if they can cultivate the individual passions. I would say actually Novartis is certainly in an unusual class there. Most institutions today are still, again, they are deeply suspect of the passion. And so it's there are early instances. I'd say they're largely driven by individuals who see that the current approach to business and the current approach to our communities is not achieving what the participants want or need. and are starting to be drivers of change, but it's still very early days. I'd say, again, as a generalization, most communities, most institutions are still very tightly wedded to the traditional approach.
So, John, you make some very interesting points in the book about the need for that lifelong learning. And coming back to the title of the book, how the unstated assumption appears to be that it's actually driven by fear in many instances, and a fear that actually we're not updating our skills and therefore, you know, we risk losing our jobs and therefore we need to learn. So if many are only prompted by fear to learn, but it's really only embraced by those who have the passion of the explorer or are curious, I guess, where does that leave us? So tell us more between the differences of those who just learn because of fear and those who really have that passion to learn.
It's one of my big frustrations is, again, lifelong learning has become kind of a buzzword in the business world. Everybody's talking about the need to do lifelong learning. As far as I know, very few, if any, people are talking about the motivation to learn.
Yes.
Why would they do that? That requires a lot of effort, takes risk, it's, you know, time consuming. Why would you do that? Well, and when I press on it, when I push on it, the answer I get from leaders is, well, if they don't, they're gonna lose their jobs. So get with it. Lifelong learning is critical, but that's fear, right? That plays to the fear. And again, I think this is part of my broad perception and one of the reasons we're seeing fear as an increasingly dominant emotion is our leaders are playing to fear. I mean, one of the, again, a bit of a detour, but one of the things that I see in companies that are trying to drive change, transformation, is what I call the burning platform image, right? If we don't change, we're going to die. So get with it. But that plays to fear again. We're going to die? Oh my God, no. We got to hold on to what we have and not try to do anything new or different. That's too risky. And so again, I think in the learning side, and this particularly applies again to the distinction, which very few companies in my experience make, between learning in the form of sharing existing knowledge versus learning in the form of creating new knowledge. And, you know, again, when I talk to executives, they say, when I talk about learning, they say, oh, we do learning. We have training programs. You know, employees can go to training programs. The problem in a rapidly changing world is that the knowledge that we have today is becoming obsolete at an accelerating rate. So if we're just focused on sharing existing knowledge, good luck. That's a diminishing returns proposition. The only way we're going to be successful in a rapidly changing world is by creating new knowledge. But guess what? That's much riskier. That requires us doing things that we've never done before, and where failure is going to be a natural outcome. So why would you do, if you're driven by fear, when are you going to do that? You know, you'll stick to reading the textbooks and listening to lectures. That's okay. But tell me I have to do something that's going to have the risk of failure? Good luck. So that's where I think the emotions become particularly, if people aren't really excited about the opportunity to have more impact and willing to come together in ways where they can support each other on that, I think it's going to be very hard for people with fear to do that kind of learning.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
I think there's two really important points, though, in what you're saying there, John. So one is, you know, how do we move from stick to carrot on the why to learn? So rather than that we will risk being unemployed if we don't keep our skills up to date, actually, how do we ignite that passion so that people can be curious and want to learn more and want to move things forward? But then I think the second point is really interesting is to say, actually, also maybe there's a reframing of learning because of the speed that things are changing, that in many fields, actually, it's not about learning how someone else thinks things were previously, but it's creating that new knowledge, that new way of doing things. So does that mean, if we look across the whole learning industry, myself included, a big part of what we've done in the past is, you know, How do we train people with the existing knowledge, as opposed to how do we experiment? How do we push boundaries? How do we try new things, which as you say, will fail along the way, but is the only way potentially to navigate in the ambiguity and the accelerating world we see. So have we been doing the wrong thing for many years?
No, don't get me started. I've been working for decades with large companies, and I believe they're very much stuck in the old model. And it's what I call scalable efficiency model, where the key to success is becoming more and more efficient at scale, doing things faster and cheaper at scale. And it's all about efficiency of operations. Learning is kind of a distraction. We'll do that if certain needs come up. But the focus is on getting people to just follow the process manual and do it without error. And I think that we're now in a world where that kind of model, scalable efficiency, I love paradox, scalable efficiency is becoming increasingly inefficient. Yeah. Because we are confronted more and more on a daily basis with situations we've never encountered before, that were not part of the process manual. And that workers are scrambling at the last minute to try to figure out, how do we address this unforeseen situation? And so I think that that's where this form of learning becomes really essential, is actually not just, accepting it, but embracing it, saying, yes, we need to help people to find ways to address these unforeseen situations in a way that'll have much more impact, and motivate them through their emotions, through passion, to do that. And so I would say, and again, I'll just come back that it's not just the individual. I have a strong view again around this notion of impact groups. And I will say, I've done a lot of work around the practices that impact groups can adopt that will help them to accelerate learning and performance improvement. But one of the practices in that context is what I call productive friction. And it's this notion that in these impact groups, they're small groups, but one key is to get as much diversity as you can within that impact group. People from different backgrounds, different races, different genders, different everything, so that they're coming together with a whole different set of experiences and mindsets and approaches, so that they can then challenge each other, come up with challenges that you would have never anticipated if you had everybody who went to the same schools and had the same training. And, yeah, exactly. It's making the friction productive in the sense, again, in our existing institutions, if you challenge somebody, it's clearly with the purpose of putting them down, advancing your own agenda and putting them down.
It's amazing. You really make me think about confidence. And we talk about the need. You can't be successfully curious unless you have a background or a platform of growing confidence, and you exist within a psychological safety. That's at the individual level. In the group level, when we talk about our curiosity engine being both the idea of creativity, but also the idea of constructivist work, that you are making things and learning by making, and as you say, creating new knowledge. It reminds me of two of the stories, Venice again. Each of those guilds, each of those scuole required people to bring new knowledge and continually present new knowledge to the brotherhood, if you like. There were female guilds as well, but they had to make new knowledge. They had to take what they'd learned on their journeys and present that to their brethren and move the knowledge forward. And that went into their archives. And the same is true even today of, I don't know if you know the Basque people up in San Sebastian in Spain. They have an amazing set of sort of not guilds, but kind of groups, small groups, about 20 people at a time, who focus on food. And everybody cooks for their group on sometimes a daily basis, and that whoever the cook is shifts, and they have to replace what's in the larder. And these little groups are social groups, of course, but you can imagine the quality of cooking and food is spectacular at San Sebastian, because the knowledge is moving forward continuously, and they're competing with each other, and everybody's using fresh ingredients and outperforming local and organic and fantastic. And it's absolutely built into the way that the Basque people organize themselves in that part of Spain. And it reminds me completely of when you talk about these impact groups, and when you talk about productive friction and so on. You find them in these groups. And I think these are coming into our organizations because of the digital.
Yeah, again, I would be cautious. I don't think they're coming in. And the culture in most organizations, and we've adopted diversity now as a good, a social good. We need to be more diverse. We bring in more diverse people into the organization, we sit them around the table, and then what's the message we give them? Follow the leader. And the leader is an older white guy. Try to be as much like him as you possibly can. That's the key to success. Yeah. And to me, diversity is not just a social good, it is a business imperative. If we don't have that diversity and encourage the people around the table to actively challenge each other, we're not going to learn as fast as we need to. And so, again, to me, it's a completely different culture and way of operating a business that I'd see very few companies today.
No, that's a great warning. I mean, it's a great heads up for us, actually, to say we have to work hard to bring these things into the culture, as you say.
Oh, yeah.
John, speaking of business imperatives, I want to come back to your point about the lack of passion in organizations. You did a recent survey where you found, I think, that only 14%, was it, of the US workforce has passion about their work. I'm curious, I have a couple of questions about this. Firstly, did you find if this was mainly about commitment, the questing disposition, as you describe it, and connecting with others? And my second question was, what can organizations do about this?
It's a great question. I mean, we didn't ask people if they were passionate, because, again, we'd get so many different meanings and definitions. We asked about specific forms of behavior that we believe are key to the passion of the explorer. You know, when confronted with a new challenge, are they excited about it? When confronted with a challenge, do they try to connect with others? Those were the kinds of questions. And then we integrated and brought together and said, how many are really showing the full passion explorer? And it was 14%. I actually view that as incredible success of those 14%. I mean, despite all the pressure in their organizations, they somehow are maintaining their passion. This is amazing. So anyway, I think that, I believe most organizations view passion as suspect. It's people who ask questions all the time. Why would you want to ask questions? Just read the manual and follow the manual. It's people who want to take risks. Why would you want to take risks? We want to get things done reliably and efficiently and, you know, just deliver as expected. And so the passionate people are really discouraged from pursuing their passion. And by the way, that I'll just say as a bit of a detour, that starts with school. One of the things that I get a lot of pushback on when I talk about the passionate explorer is people say, some of us are capable of this kind of passion, but most of us just want to be told what to do and get a reliable paycheck. And my response to that is, okay, let's go to a playground and let's look at children 6 or 7 years old. Show me one that isn't curious and imaginative and creative and excited about doing things they've never done before. We all had that passion. What happened? We went to school. And our school systems are constructed explicitly to crush that passion. The whole focus, I've studied, at least in the U.S., the public school system was explicitly designed to take unruly children and help them to become factory workers, to follow instructions reliably and efficiently. And so I think that we are, starting with our schools and then our institutions, we are actively trying to crush that passion. The fact that there are only 14, that there are still 14% who have the passion, yes. And I want to get to Paul's question about the, what do you do about it?
What can we do about it? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it, again, it has to do with rethinking our institutions at a fundamental level. I call the institutional model that is going to succeed in the future one that is a model of scalable learning. And a key part of that is redefining work. You know, we all talk about the future of work, but very few people go to the most basic question, which is what should work be to begin with? Hmm. And I'm going to generalize again, but at least in my experience, work in most large institutions today is tightly specified, highly standardized tasks. Just follow the manual. My belief is actually that work is going to be taken by technology and yes. Good riddance. That was work that humans were never meant to do.
Sure.
But it frees us up now to redefine work at a fundamental level and say that work in the future should be about addressing unseen problems and opportunities to create more value. Wherever you are in the organization, not just in a research lab or an innovation center, but if you're a janitor in a building, if you're a maintenance worker, if you're in the factories, how can you address unseen problems and opportunities to create more value? And at least, again, in my experience, when you redefine work in that way, passion starts to come out because now you're making a real difference. Nobody saw that problem or opportunity, and the value that's been created is really meaningful. So I think that's one piece. I'll also, and there are a whole bunch of pieces that come together, but another piece that I think is critical for drawing out passion goes back to leadership. How do leaders behave? In a scalable efficiency world, the mark of a strong leader is someone who has an answer to every question. No matter what the question, you can count on the leader to have an answer. I believe in the scalable learning world that we're going into, the mark of a strong leader is the one who has the most powerful questions.
Hmm.
And who will freely admit they don't have an answer and ask for help. That sends a very powerful message to the workforce to say, questions are important, questions are good, and it's okay to acknowledge that you don't know and ask for help. That starts to draw out the passion because now I get really excited by this question that nobody's answered. And, you know, what can I do to make a difference here?
Your thinking is so aligned to ours, John, that we've talked on here before around sort of learning in the flow of work, but even going one step beyond that into sort of work is learning and learning is work. And if you define learning in the context that you did earlier, that learning is finding new ways of doing things, then, you know, work is all about finding new ways of doing things. It's around innovation. It's around, you know, improving and doing something that someone hasn't done before. And that gives you the sustainable competitive advantage. And we've had similar discussions, particularly with Lisa Bodell on here around the power of questions. And yeah, that, you know, answers are easy. Questions is where it really matters, that you can Google anything and find an answer. But actually, it's asking good questions, and particularly the role of the leaders to be asking good questions, because it will be things that we don't know the answers to. If we're asking the right questions, we're not going to know the answers, because it's pushing boundaries and trying to move us forward. So, yeah, hugely exciting.
Now, it's I'll just quickly say too, part of my broader research is around the what I call the big shift in the world, the long term forces that are reshaping our global economy. And again, there's a paradox in the big shift. At one level, it is creating mounting performance pressure on all of us. Competition is intensifying. pace of change accelerating, unexpected events coming in. That's the reason there's so much fear, because we're experiencing that on a daily basis. At the same time, those same forces are creating exponentially expanding opportunity. We have the ability to create far more value with far less resource, far more quickly than was ever imaginable in the past. But the only way we're going to harness that, number one, is moving beyond the fear, because if we just have a fear mindset, all we're going to do is focus on the pressure of the moment and finding ways to learn faster so that we can scale to address these opportunities. So anyway.
John, that's a lovely segue into the next question I was really keen to ask. You spent a lot of your career looking at the future and the future of work. I mean, it's been an amazing and massively unpredicted, I suppose, 12, 18 months. But what are your latest thoughts on what this future may look like now? And has this changed much over the past 12 months?
Again, I'm going to generalize, and I think that at least in my experience, strong leaders are focused on what they call resilience, which is, and again, definitions matter. The way they define resilience is the ability to bounce back, to get back to where we were. That's success. They just want to get back to where we were. And at the same time, in the broader organization, I'm hearing more and more from people in the organization saying that this pandemic has been a catalyst for them to really reflect on what's meaningful to them. What is it that's really exciting and important, and finding that they're consumed by tasks that are not at all exciting. And so their motivation now, as we come out of the pandemic, is to find something different, that they can, where they can really pursue this. And I think, again, the institutions that recognize that need and desire and create an environment that will encourage people to do this are going to be the ones that succeed, while those who are just wanting to get back to where they were, good luck.
I have a question for you, John, about curiosity. We call it the greatest driver of value in the digital age. When we talk about our definition of curiosity, we talk about having an attitude of wonder, but a spirit of exploration. And I guess we're wondering, how would you define curiosity in terms of your perspective?
Well, I think definitions differ and matter. I've tended to focus on curiosity as what I call a capability. And the distinction I make is, everybody talks about skills and skill building. To me, skills are things that are important or valuable in a specific context. How to operate this machine in this environment, how to process this kind of paperwork. To me, capabilities, and I include curiosity in this, are things that are valuable in every context. No matter where you are, that will be valuable to have. But again, I think the way most people define curiosity, it's asking desire to learn and understand and ask questions. Having read your book, I believe the way you're defining curiosity is much richer and much deeper, in the sense, again, of focusing on action, learning through action versus just asking a question. And to me, the distinction I would make too, although I think it's there in your book as well, is for me, the people who have passion are very committed to a specific domain. They have a focus of their curiosity. They're not just curious about everything. They're curious about how to get more impact in the domain that really excites them. And so to me, that's, I absolutely believe it is going to be critical in this digital world, this big shift world, given the accelerating pace of change. If we're not curious, if we're not driven to have more and more impact in whatever domain that matters to us and learn through action, good luck. We're going to be marginalized.
Well, I mean, if there's one person who has an enormous sort of scope across an enormous across their domain, it's you. And you write so broadly and widely from so many perspectives within your domain. It's fascinating, and it's brilliant to talk with you, John. I'm wondering, what are you personally curious about at the moment?
Well, my passion has evolved over time, and it's part of what I write about in the book. But my passion and curiosity at this point is this notion of developing and deploying learning platforms that can help people on the journey beyond fear. What do those platforms look like? How would you design them? And more importantly, how would you deploy them and evolve them over time, given seeing what how the participants use it and where they find the most value?
So we've covered a multitude of things there, John, from the narratives and how narratives don't have ends, that we need to act on them and actually write our own ending around the passion of the explorer and how we identify our domain, we seek challenge and need to find who to connect with. And then learning platforms of actually helping us to discover new learning rather than existing learning and actually push boundaries. But if you had to sum up into one thing that our listeners should take away from our conversation today, what would that be?
Wow, one thing? I don't know. thing. maybe a couple of things, but I'd say that the key message for me is that the fear that we're feeling today is not limited to the pandemic. It's much more enduring. There are much more fundamental forces at work that will persist. And that fear is very limiting on all of us. And so we all need to find ways to cultivate emotions that are going to help us to act in spite of fear and cultivate capabilities like curiosity.
Fantastic, John. Thank you very much. So don't let fear be your limiting factor, would be a summary of that. So do check out John's book, so The Journey Beyond Fear. I assume, John, available through Amazon and all good book retailers. Yep.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
So thank you so much for joining us, John.
Thank you, John.
A pleasure. Yes, thank you for your interest, for sure. Thank you for your curiosity.
Thank you.
Very much looking forward to your book coming out, I have to say.
Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So you've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, and there's plenty to choose from, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what have you learned from it. We always appreciate hearing from our listeners and having a curious conversation. So join today. Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your copy now to further explore the Seven Seas model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.